All right. So interestingly enough, there's nobody on Zoom. I hope I joined the right meeting. It's usually at least a few people, but okay. Can one of you try to connect to the Zoom meeting just to make sure that I'm in the right one? Good. Thanks, Melina, for connecting. You reassured me that I'm in the right meeting. I was starting to doubt myself. Yes, so the plan, I have the wrong Jupyter open. So the plan today is to do a little bit more TensorFlow probability. So I was a bit in doubt if I should just steam on or you know, do a bit of repetitive work in TensorFlow probability and Christos and I agreed that it would be a good idea to, you know, see one more example. So that's a bit the plan for today. And hopefully today, even though looking at my material, maybe not, but I'll try to give you a bit of time at least to do collaborative work as well. But I think, you know, getting a bit better at the hang of TensorFlow probability is probably worth it. So let me go to the right. Too many Jupyters open. I will fix that. Good. And let me share my screen. Okay. Okay, so the idea for today is to do a very, very simple and you know, a lot of the data analysis that we do here shouldn't be taken too seriously anyway, but especially today's. But I thought it would be a fun idea to look at how, in principle, one would analyze the COVID infection data and get an estimate of this R number, which is the infectivity. And in the real world, you would look at different groups of the population differently because, you know, so students mingle more among themselves and you know, the older folk mingle more amongst themselves. And so you would do something way more sophisticated than we do today. But in general, sort of the idea is always, okay, you have some sort of probabilistic model that would predict, given the cases today, how many would we see together given an R, and then you model that. And there's, of course, a lot of uncertainty about how many cases do we really capture. Okay. So out of the cases out there, how many do we do we catch with our tests? So then you would sort of look at the testing numbers as well, impute missing data in a way. And also that we won't look at today, not to make things too complicated. So let's start with looking a bit at the numbers, and then there's a neat thing that you can do. GitHub. So there is the John Hopkins University has this data set that they actually put on GitHub. And whenever you have data on GitHub, actually you can load that pretty much directly into your pandas. So that's pretty neat, and I'll show you how to do this. So the time series that we're interested is confirmedcasesglobal.csv. And that's a big file, but in GitHub you have, so this is how the CSV file looks. You know, you have by province, some countries you have by province, latitude, longitude, so to put it put it nicely in a map. So we need to do some massaging of this data. But there's this nice button, raw. And we can just copy the link here and start basically there. So let's do our usual imports. We want pandas. We want TensorFlow STF. We want import TensorFlow probability STFP. We want for later matplotlib. And we want NumPy for reasons that will be more apparent later. Then we want our alias for our distributions. And we want matplotlib inline. Now, actually, I don't have to say that explicit anymore. So our URL is this guy that I just copy-pasted from. So it's just copied from this button, right? So that's the nice thing. If you have a Git repository, on GitHub with the CSV file, you can basically load this directly in pandas. And it's good practice to have, you know, so that the lines are not that long. You can just put multi-line strings in parentheses like so. And that will work. So this is our URL. Okay. So our raw data frame is pandas.read.csv URL. And we're done. Pretty easy. Now what we probably want to do is we want probably to start with deleting the lat and long, right? So those aren't of no real importance to us. And so the general idea of what I want to do now is, so I'm not so interested in the province. So what I'll do is I'll make a multi-index out of those two and smudge them into one. So I'm just interested in the country, not in the province. So I'll do some sort of group by and just sum them up. And then you know, whenever we work with time series, you want really the timestamp as the index. So what we'll then do is take this whole guy and transpose it so that we have the country as the column names and the time stamp here as the row index. But the latitude, longitude will mess that up, right? So if I transpose, then I have an index of lat, long, and then some dates. So I can't have that. So I'll have to delete those two, like so. Now my raw data frame looks like this. Good. So now I need to set the index of this guy. Raw data frame dot set index. And now I can do something that's a multi-index. So I take this country region and the province state as an index. So that's a nice feature of pandas. Right, so now these guys are index. So I go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on to this guy. So let's call this df now. And, you know, keep this raw df intact. And then we do data is okay, so let's take this step by step. So let's first transpose it. Transpose. So that's so now we're almost in the right on the right track. We have to sum this up. And we can do this by saying let's take Australia, which has a lot of provinces in here, right? So as an example. So what we can do is so df Australia gives us those guys. And if I say sum, I get it by province. So now I need to say axis equal 1 and I get what I want. So this is the time series that I want. Right, so now I want to do this for all of them. So I could say something like df column dot sum axis equal 1 for c in, and now I need to say df dot columns dot get level values 0. So this gives me the values of this first multi-index, namely the country, right? So this gives me a time series for each country. And now we're almost done. So instead of a list comprehension, I use a dict comprehension. Right, so now I have Afghanistan, the time series, Albania, the time series, and so on. And out of this, I can make a pandas data frame. And I'm there. Messy, but this is the life of data science. So often it is messy. And now, actually, before I do this, so one thing I might want to do is before going through this step, so this is not a time index yet, right? So this is still a string. I have not taken care of that. So, but this is easy. If I say set index, df.index is a type object, right? That's not a datetime, but pandas.toDateTime takes care of that. Now, then I get a datetime index, and now I just say df.setIndex, this guy. And I have a proper datetime index. Which won't change anything, but that this is now a proper datetime index. So my data is now this guy. So data, Italy, for example. Now it looks like this. So this, and this is the total confirmed cases. All right. So, and typically what you would want to do is put this in a function, right? So these get data, you would probably have a get data method that puts this together in one. Okay. So the first step is done. And now what we basically want to do is, so there is this SIR model of infection, how do you call it? The science going with infectious disease. So that's the, it's a numerical model for infectious disease spread, SIR. And this SIR model is basically saying, well, the population has three stages, or three possible states. And this is susceptible. This is those that haven't been sick yet and are susceptible to the disease. Infected is those that catch the disease, and recovered. And recovered can mean recovered, like normal people would consider recovered, or dead. So this model doesn't make a distinction between that. The recovered is basically meaning that you are not susceptible to the disease anymore, right? So you're not in this susceptible group. And there's a wonderful, now of course there's a wonderful Wikipedia article on this SIR model, because everybody talks about it, and the good people of Wikipedia have our back here. But and now I again try to LaTeX on the fly, I should stop doing that, but di over dt. So it's a differential equation that basically says, here we go. So the change in you don't want to let me edit. So the change of the number of infected people over time. So this would be basically the slope of this curve, right? So the change of the number of infected over time is beta, and then times susceptible times infected over n minus gamma I. Why doesn't it? So sometimes it does later, sometimes it does not. So this basically means, okay, so the let's say that the number of susceptible people is roughly, so n is the size of the population, right? So let's say that susceptible and n is almost identical, right? So if you have a disease with, you know, a couple of 10,000 people that get infected and a couple of million in the population. So this was certainly true at the beginning. Now at the second wave, it's maybe not as true anymore, but we need to make some simplifying assumptions here. So let's say the S and N is roughly the same. So then we basically have, so the infected, the change of the number of infected over time, well, it must be kind of proportional to the number that are infected, right? So the more infected people you have in the population, the more they will infect, right? So that's why we have this exponential growth. But then we have also some sort of gamma, and so beta is basically saying how effective is the disease in infecting more people, right? So that's the coefficient of the exponential. And then gamma breaks the disease, and that's basically how quickly people recover. Right, so that's the two main parameters that a disease has. How quickly can it infect new people, and how quickly do people recover? And what you call R0 or R is the coefficient of those. So it's beta over gamma. It's basically for each newly infected, how many people do recover? And if more people get infected, then they then recover. So this is very simplified, right? But in this simple model, If people recover more quickly than they get infected, R is smaller than one, and the disease will die out, right? So here R is fraction. So it's beta. Probably I don't need those, but okay. Gamma. Okay, so that means what I have to do is, instead of these individual total, the grand total, I want the differential, right? So I want approximation for di to dt. Well, I mean, yeah.
That was the supposed model new people will get.
Right? Yeah.
So shouldn't it just be, oh, because the more there are infected. Okay, yeah.
Right, so this is basically the infected being, so the more you have susceptible, the quicker you infect, but also you need infected to infect more people. So that's why it's this S times I. So it's S over N is the susceptible fraction of the population, right? And then those infected. And then you know, more sophisticated models look at, okay, to how many people does an infected person have contact at all? Because actually, it depends on the average size of social circles and so on. And so Volker Hess Institute has a super advanced model that, you know, has multiple stages. And it's actually quite interesting. There is a, on the TensorFlow probability documentation page, there is a very sophisticated model that they go through. I don't know if it's the Hopkins model, but you know, one of those universities made one. Yes, so we want to, and if you look at this, right, so you can almost guess how the solution to this is. It's some exponential, right? And in that exponential, there's going to be something like one minus RR times, yeah. So it's, and then you need some sort of the time step. So there's going to be this TC in there. So just staring at this, you can guess the solution. It's one of those differential equations where, you know, so if DI over DT is proportional to something times I, you know what the solution to this is. But okay, let's do a little bit of more massaging. So what we want to do is, so confirmed is, so let's look at the Italy case. And that's more or less because I tried it yesterday and the results are not crazy because there's, you know, and it's basically a question of data quality, right? So maybe you heard the UK, they had a lot of cases registered in Excel and someone lost the Excel file because it was like an old format and they tried to update and they lost like data on a couple of 10,000 people. So it's, you know, but this is real world stuff. So I think it's a nice example because of that. Okay, so what I want to do is basically saying, so my delta or deltas is my confirmed cases minus confirmed dot shift by one day. All right, so my rough approximation of this DI over DT is yesterday versus today. You could use a more sophisticated approximation to the differential here. You could use it like a symmetric or whatever you like, but okay. So now if you say deltas, let's say 2020-10, so of October, those are those cases, and I plot them, this looks very messy. And this is typically because the testing numbers, they come in on it. So if you look at Volker Hesse Institute's data, they have a peak over the week and then lower during the weekend. And that's not a real artifact in the data. That's just, you know, the testing doesn't happen on Sundays, or people, you know, start coughing on a Sunday and they go to the doctor on a Monday, something like this. So what we'll do is actually use a rolling average. And to do that, we'll use the, and this is a very easy right, so any time series in pandas has this rolling average function. And here you give it a window type. For this analysis, I used like a 7-day average. So 7-day average, but not just a simple rolling average, but I used a window type Gaussian. So that's basically sort of a rolling average, but instead of taking the like 7 days, dividing by, sum them up, divide by seven, you weight by how far the date was away from the date that I'm interested in. So this gives you a smoothing, but a smoothing that's a bit more localized. So Gaussian window, if you use a Gaussian window, you need to give it a standard deviation. So it's sort of how peaked or flat the bell curve shall be. So, sorry. I take the mean with a standard deviation of 3. And for good measure, let's get rid of the nuns and round, because so, and this is an important step. So we'll use some sort of Okay. So you have people that get infected with some rate. Yeah. So what will the underlying probability process be? If we have rates and counts, it's probably some sort of Poisson process, right? And if you use Poisson distribution, you need whole numbers. So we don't want 3,780.04 cases. We want whole numbers, right? So we round this. Yes, and that shall be our case. So K, because, and I call them K because that's what you have in a Poisson process. Okay. No. So you get still, so you have this Gaussian window that you move through the data set, yeah, and you average over those for each day. So you still get, so let's plot this again, case of 2020, October. So they now look, you know, much smoother. So all this wiggling is taken out. And that's basically also, it's a bit of a dirty trick, because what I want to do is I want to use successive, so I don't want a estimation of RT later at one point in time, but I want to use sort of, let's say, three consecutive days as my input of the model, as my observations of the model. And then if I have something like this, so first it goes down and then it goes up again, the probability estimates will be so different that I get zero probability mass for my total model. So it's a little bit, okay, yeah, dirty tricks, but okay. So let's make a very, very simple model. No prior, just to get you started a bit. Very simple. So, you know, okay, R's, they are, so the infection rate should be something between, let's say, 0.5. Even though looking at this, no one will believe in 0.5, but okay, 0.5 to 2 in steps of 100, no, 1,000 actually. So I make my linear space. And then my model, I can just say, so I use a Poisson model. And okay, the rate of the model is now, if you think about it, so looking back at this, so this is the infected. And I said, okay, this di over dt, it's something proportional to I. So I is a sort of exponential function. So the number of infected are exponential. And now I'm interested in kind of the slope of that exponential again. Yeah. So it's something like let's look at one date. So the yesterday's infections, infected people, 2020, and I just pick a random date here, 4th of October, and then this exp of, and then it's R's minus one, and then you need to normalize this guy. And the normalization is this TC, the time that someone needs to infect. And, you know, this is estimated in a bunch of studies around 5.2, doesn't matter so much. So the data is not so sensitive on this. And this is basically, so this is the only thing that you have to believe me, but staring a bit at how this looks, right? So the exponential comes from, well, this is beta minus gamma I, and then you divide by gamma, and then you get this RS minus one over 5.2, and that's just to get R on the same scale as our data, because our data is in a daily, while this infectious, the incubation, it's not the incubation period, but the period in which you're infectious is like 5.2 days. So it's, I can point you to a paper where they do the math. But this is pretty much it. So now we actually get a posterior with that. So we have no prior in here. So this is, this is our model in the end of the day. TF. This is our model. So now we can say, given and as we did usually. So this is actually a bunch of models, right? So this is 1,000 different models with different values of R. And now I can ask my models, what is the probability of the case that I try to predict? And that's basically on the next day. Let's call this models to be precise, right? So I have different R's and each model has one given R. And with that, I'll just see sort of which of the models is the most plausible, right? And it's really saying here, well, going from, so let's look at the case again. Right, so on the fourth, we had 2,230, and on the fifth, we had 2,368. So going from here to here, solving this equation, the most plausible R is somewhere in the 1.2, 1.4 range. And the interesting thing here is, again, we get a range of observations. And also sort of, if you think about Poisson distributions, the smaller the counts, the less peak they become. So if you go like from 50 to 55 cases, the range of plausible R's will be wider than going from 2,300 to, right? So if I were to divide each of them by 10 now, right? So let's make that experiment. So I have less observations effectively. This will be much broader because I don't have enough examples to have my probability mass really concentrated. What did I do now? I did not rerun this. Okay. But this is, you know, boring stuff. This you have already seen a while back. So it's really, you know, remember this very simple binomial example that we have, right? So we have a model with one parameter. We have no prior on this or uniform prior, and then we just try out different values for our parameter and see what is the most plausible. So let's make this a little bit more exciting. Let's use a prior. So I make a new model, and we use this joint distribution named that you saw the last time. So we make a prior now for our R. And let's say we do a normal centered around one with standard distribution or standard variant. Standard deviation of 2, just to have something, right? So the R should be around 1. If I get a 10 for COVID, it doesn't seem very plausible. So that's my prior. Prior on R. And then my count, and that is a Poisson. And the rate is the same here. Okay, a good practice, we can resolve the graph. Right, so just to see if I made a mistake here. Instead of R, I named this T. Oh no, that's interesting. Ah, sorry, no. lambda R goes to this guy. Ah, good, yeah. So, right, so this is the prior on R, and this is the P of K given R, right? So this is TensorFlow probabilities of saying, so this is the conditional probability. And now if I were to misspell this, it would complain saying no key named R, right? So that's why this name, joint distribution named, is so nice. And now I can sample from my model, right? So now it chose a negative R because this normal 1, 2 will sample from a negative space or from the negative part of the real axis. And then you get this weird So this would mean a strong, I don't know even what that would mean. So it doesn't make any sense in the model to have this negative, but okay. But now I can go back to my range of R's and I can do the same thing. So I can plot my R's against, and now I need to do a little bit of housekeeping. So I need to say model.prob, but since I have now a named model, I need to say, okay, my R, so that's the input of this, is R's. So this is this range of R's that we defined. And then I need to say for K, it's again, the K observed on the next day. And I think I should make a little comment here also. Of course, the cases that that we see today, they were of course infected around 5 days ago, according to this guy. But for that model, it doesn't make a whole of a lot of difference because, well, the people that got infected yesterday, or that got tested yesterday, they were infected 6 days ago. So it's just a matter of nomenclature, how you shift the data. But it's totally legit. I was told, at least. Talked about this with a medical doctor. So right. So now, if you observe the peak of this, So this is, you know, a bit above 1.3 maybe, and now this is shifted a bit to the left, closer to 1.2, and that's because of our prior. And if I would put a very strong prior, so instead of 2, I would put 0.2, this will be shifted even further towards if the more I peak this, the more it will push this towards my prior beliefs. So that's why if you don't have a good idea of what your parameters should be, keep the priors reasonable. But okay, so good. Um, Now we could do a bit of posterior sampling on this, but let's not do that. So that might be a nice homework to try out, doing posterior sampling on this, and then just see how plausible is our value for the K that we actually see on the next day. Good. So of course this is now our posterior, right? So the given the value for R and given the observed data. Maybe real quick map inference. So maximum a posteriori, also very easy to do here. You say you make a variable, and that can be, you know, let's start with something crazy, 5. And then you just minimize. No. TensorFlow probability has this minimize function. And I can minimize the probability, or the log prop, doesn't really matter. The minimum of the one will be the minimum of the other, or the maximum. So minus sign, right? So we minimize something, but we want maximum a posteriori. And then all we have to do is, instead of our range of R's, we now give it this variable. So R is the variable, and the K is the same. So the next day. So we now want to find that R that minimizes or maximizes the log prop of our data given that R. And now we need to do a little bit of housekeeping here. We need to say the number of optimization steps. That's 250. And we need to give it an optimizer. Luckily, TensorFlow has a lot of very good optimizers built in. So we just need to pick our favorite one. Name error. So what's happening now? Okay. Model. If you see me do typing mistakes, you just shout. Right, now we get our optimizer going. Okay, so basically my starting at 5 was a bit too far away, and maybe I could have gone a few more steps. So let's make this 500 steps. Okay, now we've optimized, and now my R is 1.3, which, you know, optically you would say, yeah. And again, so the Poisson distribution with the normal distribution as a prior, it's nothing crazy, right? I could do all this analytically. But if I have like really exotic distributions here, or distributions that you numerically approximate from some data, or you have like very deep multi-level models, it's good to have these numerical tools at hand. But again, of course, MAP only gives you the point estimate, that where you have your maximum a posteriori. What you're really interested in is this range. So okay, how probable is it that I'm close to 1? Or, you know, and this would immediately influence government's policies, right? So if you say, yeah, 1 is a probability, but it might as well be 1.5, you would not loosen any restrictions, right? If you're very much peaked around 1, then you say, well, it's, you know, we're pretty golden. So let's make this a little bit more interesting. So maybe we take a short breather here, and then we'll make the model a little bit more complicated. Questions so far? I put the first version on GitHub, so you can have a look and interesting. There's a 7-day old. Interesting. So I didn't upload this. No. No. I need to push tab to get autocomplete. But I have a quite recent version of Jupyter Notebook. So I crashed my computer just before the course started and had to reinstall everything. So I don't know. I messed up with the virtual env that I'm using. So I had to like reinstall all the packages. So what? 2 months ago, so it can be that. It's just about like newer versions.
My installation was autocomplete.
Oh.
It only autocompletes my own variables.
Ah. Yeah, maybe you need to have Pylint or something like this installed. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, when I do stuff for myself, I usually use Visual Studio Code. And that there the autocomplete is very good. And it also supports notebooks.
Yeah.
But like for teaching, I think black on white is much better than white on black. And
I also put up the
Victor
integration
as a code. Yeah. And again, so if you do if you do like serious work, it's much, much better to have a code file. So have a script rather than Jupyter Notebook. So it's really like for teaching, it's great. For explaining stuff, it's also great, but like for serious work, scripts. Let's maybe continue. So the next thing I want to do is something that's quite usual when you do time series in a Bayesian framework. You will use sort of yesterday's estimate for today's as today's prior. And so if you have seen R yesterday and nothing, so of course there can be switch points and things like this, but if you know the none of the variables in your model, like the I and the S and the N did not really change, at least not significantly. And you didn't do anything to, so you have no new treatments that would affect beta, gamma, or you have no new sort of mask obligations or things like this that would influence this beta, you would kind of expect similar R today than you saw yesterday, right? So what we now try to, or will do is use this Poisson. You can just give it, I know we did this multiple times. So you can give these, all these distributions, you can give them vectors of values and they will then just, and this is basically three independent Poisson distributions with independent rates. And if you sample from that again, you get three numbers. And so we could take them as independent, or we could sort of say, okay, the one that we saw before is the prior of the other, is the prior of the other. So that's what we'll do. And just as a random choice, again, you can play around with the data all you like. What we'll do today is go from the 4th of October to the 6th of October. Again, careful with those time series. It's inclusive, so it's a bit confusing sometimes. So it's the 6th, including the 6th. Anyway, so these three numbers, and we kind of assume that the rays was connected to the same process, so the same R. So to make this now into a model, word of warning when you use these NumPy arrays. Sometimes TensorFlow is a bit weird in how it interprets those. So just to be sure that we're not shooting ourselves in the foot, we will make a TensorFlow constant out of those cases. And a lot of this comes with, so the default in TensorFlow is 32-bit floating points, while NumPy likes 64-bit floating points. And then TensorFlow tries to compile this into code that runs on your graphics card and then just throws up its hands and says, nah, I don't know what to do with that. And most graphics cards cannot deal with 64-bit floating points easily. So we'll just cast this into our float 32. And then we're ready again to make our model. And it will look very much like this guy. Um, The only distance, so just to be a bit more interesting, so still we have one R, right? So we just need one prior, but let's use a truncated normal. And we can make this a bit wider, but then we say, don't go below zero and don't go higher than 10. And this is, you know, just a normal distribution that you chop off. And then since it's all analytical, the things that you chop off on the low and the high side, you add that in equal parts to the total distribution so that it, again, in the integral is one. Just, you know, there's a lot of stuff in TensorFlow probability distributions. So there's the craziest stuff in there. And now this is harder to solve analytically also. So it's a bit more interesting. And what we now do is again, our Poisson distribution. Now we need to be a bit careful though. So what we want is an independent distribution. And this basically just makes so this takes a bunch of points from our so as I said, these are basically three distributions that have nothing to do with each other. And the what this does in practice is, well, multiplying those together to, you know, it's these three will be considered as independent distributions, and to make a total probability out of those, you just multiply them together. So this is just a fancy way of saying, yeah, we consider these three Poissons that we get in here as independent. So now we use our TensorFlow K array. And now one extra thing. So let's leave it like this for now. I need to give it this independent needs to know which axis should it multiply along, because we can have a matrix valued thing here. We'll see that in a second. No. Oh, okay. So again, so if I sample from this, I get one randomly chosen value for R and three values for our case, right? And I can actually say model.prob of model.sample. So this gives me one number. If I would have left those guys out, if I would have left this independent out, I would get three point estimates for the variable, for the three estimates from this Poisson. So that's all that independent does. Now, there's one little ingredient missing. So what if instead of saying, I give it R and I give it, sort of the next step down. So from the fifth to the seventh. I get a number. But what if I want to now have multiple estimates for R in there? So instead of just one, I want you know, a point estimate for 1.3 and 2. Now this gives me an error. And what basically this long message is saying is, I don't know how to multiply these things together. I have something of shape 2 and 3, right? So here in this R, I throw in something of shape 2, and these K's have a shape of 3. I don't know what to do with that. And what I actually want to tell TensorFlow is, I don't want you to do anything with that. I got this, right? So don't worry about it. So I just say, well, my R's just make a new axis for those. Just don't multiply anything fancy, just treat it as a new thing. And then I get those two estimates. And this will be super helpful later when we do Monte Carlo, because then we can run 3 or 4 chains in parallel using this same estimate. Or the same estimator. So let's do this. Let's run Monte Carlo on this. So we could now do the same thing. We could do a maximum a posteriori, or, you know, it's still a one parameter model. So we could just plug in a bunch of different values for R. But, you know, why do the simple thing. Remember that for the Monte Carlo estimate, all we need is a log prop function. And actually for some of the algorithms, even just the ratio of two probabilities. So let's define our log probability function of a given R as this guy. So we want to return this, and we want the log prop. So now we can basically say a log prop of a given R. Or even our value of R's, right? And we can plot this. Also, again, the peak is around 1.3, 1.4. But this is, of course, not a, this, so this is now log likelihood, not our probability. Good. So let's Monte Carlo this. Like before, we want some burn-in, some results, some burn-in steps, non-burn-in. And I'm just aggressive here, 1,000 results, 1,000 burn-in steps. But now we do something a bit more fancy than we did before. So before we had this one parameter that we had to tune, which was the step size, right? So for each proposition of a new value for our parameter, I did a sort of step. And what we do now is we use a adaptive method to choose the step size. And what this will do, it will sort of tune the step size such that I get a target accept probability, and it will do that during the burn-in, so it won't mess with our step size once we are starting to measure stuff. And that works like this. It's called dual averaging step size adaption. Quite a mouthful. I just read the. It's, none of these methods is super complicated theoretically. So all you do is you use some sort of method to change the step size, see how the algorithm reacts, and, you know, keep changing the step size until you get as close as possible to to your target accept probability. And we use the Hamiltonian Monte Carlo as before, with the target log prop is our log prop with three leapfrog steps with a step size of 0.5 to start with. And then we need to give this dual averaging step size adaption. We need to give this guy a number of adaption steps. So how many steps can it use to try to find a good step size? And that's, we take 80% of the burn-in steps. And that's why we chose a high number of burn-in steps here, so that the step size adaption has time to sort of do its thing. This is not really needed, this tf dot function decorator, but it makes things run faster. It optimizes something about the way TensorFlow compiles the functions. Don't worry about it. And then we're ready to run our chain. Sample chain. And then we basically just pass our parameters that we defined up here. So results, burn-in steps. Now we need a current state. Let's set this up here. So the state is, of course, np.ones. Non chains one. NumPy dot float 32. And we need to give it a kernel. And that's our adaptive HMC kernel. Now most of this is just boilerplate. So there's really not that much going on. The only thing that's different from last time is that we do this kernel within a kernel. So we have the Hamiltonian Monte Carlo as the inner one. Then we have this step size adaption, find a good step size. That's a wise thing to do. And then we basically give this HMC a kernel and a starting state. And that's basically it. And if nothing crazy happens, this should now just run through. And the thing now that we have to keep in mind a bit is this double kernel. So if we want to sort of query what is the accept rate, we need to ask the inner kernel. So you do that by saying kernel results dot inner kernel, inner results, sorry, is accepted, for example. So that's the accept rate. Okay, yeah. So this is a bit okay. If you look just at this guy, right? So this is shape 10,000. That's the number of results that we wanted to get. Four for each of the chains, right? So and now we convert this to a NumPy, and we sum it up. But I want this for each chain, so I need to say x is equal 0. So then I get four sums, one for each chain, and I divide this by num results, and I get 90% accept rate. That's very high. So good. So that means I sample much of the phase space. So now I can look at my samples. And of course, I don't expect anything crazy there. So again, 10,000 results, four chains. So that looks right. So let's look at the first chain. Now I get basically some proper numbers out. And I can histogram this. And yeah, no big surprises here neither. This, of course, looks pretty much like this. Yeah, we have a prior now. We have this successive updating that the Monte Carlo takes care of, but you're not going to get vastly different results. But again, so this is now a estimate for our infectious rate are given those 3 days. And you see, so, there's quite a range of numbers that is plausible under this model. And I can query again this, I can say, numpy dot percentiles of this guy. Or something like this. Right, or 97.5. So this would be my percentile, interpercentile range, and my median. Good. So let's do a bit of bookkeeping now. So let's see. Okay, this is the first chain. Let's see for each of my chains. So for I in range num chains. Right, so remember, right, 1,041. So this is the index into the chains that I have. So I, and then what I want is make this a bit transparent so I can see what's going on. And yeah, they're all right on top of each other. So nothing crazy going on here. And maybe it's also worth to just look at, so instead of histogramming it, let's just look at one of the chains. And the first one is as good as any. So that's the sort of trajectory that our Monte Carlo chain did. And then just to make sure that nothing crazy happened, we can calculate again this potential scale reduction. Right, it's pretty damn close to one. So there's our chains converged. They sampled the same phase space, so it's good. One last thing that I wanted to show you is, so this posterior sampling, I know it's a bit of a weird concept for some, but it's super helpful to just look at sort of, you know, in the end of the day, if you think about it in that way, each of these points here along this trajectory is a model. And the distribution of those models is well, is equal to the distribution of the parameters. So if I now draw from these distributions, it's a very good way to see, does my original data make sense under this, right? So if I just say exp of my samples, because my sample, they're now values for R, right? So R minus one divided by my TC times K, that should give me the Poisson rates, right? So TF dot tensor dots, and now I need to do a bit bookkeeping because I have so many R's and I need to multiply this together. But that's okay, TensorFlow, this guy, and no. So nothing crazy happened here. It's just, I take my samples, these guys, these are values for R already in the right. I could also draw a sample from those, but you know, that's, they already have the right distribution, so it's fine. So I take my samples, these are samples for R. So I just calculate the rate as K times exp R minus one over TC. So it's just the rates that I get out of these values for R. Now, so these are the rates for my Poisson. Good. So now I can just say my posterior is a Poisson of rates. Dot sample. So this is posterior samples drawn from my Monte Carlo estimation of the R. And you know, so I can now, for example, so three, because I have 3 days, right, that I base my observations on. And where I can, for example, plot them. So for I in range three, could also say len case tf. Don't want to have magic numbers in here. So this is my estimates for those 3 days. Let's get a few more bins and make them a bit transparent. So those are my estimates here. And then I can actually look at, so those should be the rates that I get for the days just before those days, right? So these are the observations I based my model on, and my prediction is basically for those days. And so if I look at those guys, right, 2370 around here, 2500 and 2680. So I can, this is a bit annoying. So I can just draw virtual lines with this. So I need to give it the points on the x-axis, And then min max, let's say 1,500, 1,600. And so these are my actual observed numbers. And now you can speculate. So this seems to be dead on. This is a bit on the left side, and this is a bit on the right side. So okay, what's going on here? But it's totally plausible, those numbers. Yeah, that's all for today. So just remember, so this is really still a very simple model. So it's just a prior on R and a K. And so Poisson process that gives us three observations. And we multiply those together. So it's not a complex model here. But you need to do all this bookkeeping in TensorFlow. So you need to tell it what are the shapes, how to multiply things together. So it's a bit more explicit than, for example, Stan. But in particular, if you're interested then to transfer this to neural networks and things like this, of course, this TensorFlow probability blows everything else out of the water. I mean, Stan models get translated to C++ code and then compiled, which is what makes it a bit slow at times. So you need to wait for quite a while until the model is compiled. But then it's C++, so it doesn't get much faster than that. I don't know if it supports GPU acceleration. And that's kind of the strong suit of TensorFlow, right? So they're very much on top of that. But I have worked very, very little in Stan, and it's a while ago. So I was teaching in Stan last semester, and then decided for this semester to switch to TensorFlow probability. And last semester, I was already a bit rusty in Stan. So it's a while. But there's nothing wrong with Stan. There's nothing wrong with PyMC3. It's a choice I made. You might agree or disagree. But I think, if you do neural nets and Keras, and then it's a natural thing to do the MCMC and TensorFlow probability. And TensorFlow probability is a relatively new system. So I would expect in the coming years this to become more complete and also more simple. So, and maybe, who knows, maybe one of you guys wants to write a Keras interface into TensorFlow probability. It would be nice to be able to. I have no illusion that this is a bit confusing and ugly to define your models that way, right? So it makes sense for a Python programmer, but it's probably not the most intuitive for a statistician. So if you get a bit of practice in this, it's not that terrible, right? Functions are conditional probabilities. Distributions are priors, so it's not that. Something crazy. Questions, remarks? I hope this was helpful to, see the concepts again and go through another example. But of course, so this is a toy model for COVID. Right, so don't take this too serious. Good, so then I'll just, are there questions from the internet? It's a bit of a shame, so now that I learned how to have the chat open and everything, people don't ask questions on the web. Okay, good, so I'll stop the recording and you can ask questions off the record if there are any.